The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is Woody from Bastille, and you're listening to the Stage Left Podcast.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring the likes of Gail Ann Dorsey, Stuart Lee, Tony Visconti, Steve Cropper, Miles Copeland III, as well as members of Queen, Earth, Wind & Fire, The Smashing Pumpkins, Guns N' Roses, Oasis, Radiohead, Kraftwerk, and Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, who discuss in detail their recording, writing, and performing processes. Today, we're joined by Chris Maas, who is currently mid-tour with Sting as drummer in Sting's first three-piece since his time in the Police. Today, we'll be exploring how the philosophy of music education in Luxembourg differs from the UK, how to best lock into a rhythm section with Gordon Sumner, drumming with example, and filling in for an injured Marcus from Mumford & Sons. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than Chris Maas. Thanks for joining us today, Chris. How's it going?
Thank you. Hi, mate. I'm very well. Thank you. How are you?
Yeah, we're really good. So listen, you're joining us kind of mid-tour, having played some dates in Europe recently and Ireland and the UK actually last week as we're recording. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting dynamic, obviously, only having a three-piece. When you did those first rehearsals, it must have been interesting that there was a lot of space to fill the room, I guess, with only three of you. And you mentioned that, you know, in previous iterations, Sting has played with a seven-piece. How are you going about that as a band? So how are you working with that space? Are you letting it breathe, or are you turning yourselves up? Are you trying to fill the space? How are you feeling about that space and how to go about filling it?
He's very aware of the space. And obviously, you know, we all are in terms of like this very common misconception that, you know, in a trio there's like, you know, you can't hide, and there's like, you know, everyone has to pull their weight and stuff. And sure, that is true to a certain extent, but at the same time there's also more time and more space than ever in a trio to embrace space, you know. And we all know the famous quotes of like, you know, it's all about the notes you don't play and all of that. And there's a big truth hiding in that, you know, because he loves space in music. He thinks that space in music is as important as the notes you do play. And we approach every song in a very sort of pure way of like, you know, we listen to the original, and I obviously, in preparation for the gig, I listened to, I think, pretty much every iteration or live recording of every different band he had throughout, you know, basically from like the late 80s all the way to now, which was terrifying, honestly.
Why was it terrifying?
Yeah, it was terrifying because, you know, we started the first set of rehearsals, which wasn't really a rehearsal because we'd never been in the studio as a three-piece. And I'd done very limited work with him. And he invited me to New York, and we went to New York and we booked ourselves in a studio in in Manhattan, and we spent 5 days in that studio trying to see whether his idea of stripping it down to a three-piece would actually work, because he didn't know. I certainly didn't know. But he had a hunch about it, and he was like, I think this will work. And no one would give me a set list of songs that he might pull, you know what I mean? So I was like left to wonder like what possibly he could be wanting to play. And I depped the show for the previous drummer, who's a guy called Zach Jones, who's a phenomenal drummer, took over from Josh and held the gig for a long time, and is really fantastic player. And so I depped the show for him last year. And so I came in with no rehearsals into that show. So I prepped like about 20 tracks that I felt comfortable with playing for that show. So I started with those 20, and then I basically worked around that sort of, you know, I was like, if I've got those 20 rock solid, then that's probably day one sorted or whatever. But I wasn't ready for what was about to happen, you know, which was that he walked in on day one with a list of 72 songs. Some of which I'd never heard of, you know, and I love The Police and I love Sting's music, his solo music. But some of them I was like, wow, these are deep cuts. And so we just started at the top of the list, you know, and we just rattled through that list. And on the songs that I didn't know, I tried to get through them. And it was almost like a test, you know what I mean? Like, it was almost like he wanted to see whether I would sink or swim, basically. And at times I felt like I was sinking, honestly. But, you know, he was very encouraging, and every night he would be like, you know, saying like, you know, everyone, this is working, it's working. So at the end of those 5 days, he felt like he'd heard enough to warrant to say that this is going to work and we have proof of concept now. Moving to March, 2 months later, we met again in New York and we had 4 days of production rehearsals where we fine-tuned the set, boiled it down to about 40 songs. And from there on, we didn't see each other again until the first day of tour. Wow. We had no rehearsal. There was, you know, and that was conscious. That was a conscious decision on his part to just, he was like, I don't want this to be rehearsed. Like, I want it to be raw and I want it to be fresh and I want it to be almost like a diamond in the rough, you know what I mean? But like, I feel like that's a bit too flattering to myself. But I think he's a huge fan of the risk factor. And he's a huge fan of the element of surprise. Those are like his two, basically two favorite things. And I felt like he really managed to get the best out of us in both ways, because for the first three shows, you know, like we didn't know what was happening, you know, for most, it was crazy, but it was, you know, it was very, they were really hard lifts, those shows, you know, because especially as a three piece, but at the same time, we were learning on the job so much and so quickly, and he was changing every day. So we have sound checks every day that are like, he usually does like, Dominic calls it the matinee, which is quite funny because it's, you know, we sometimes do sound checks that are an hour and a half long, an hour and a half of playing. And then you do a 2 hour show in the evening. And during that hour and a half of playing, he will go through everything we did the night before and change and tell you, I didn't like that, do that, let's cut that, put that there, change this up, let's do a segue from this song into this one, da, da, da. And then you have to put it into practice that evening.
And how are you making notes of that as you go along? So how are you remembering everything?
Yeah, pen to paper.
Yeah, it's literally that, okay. Cool.
Literally,
you've got a notepad next to you, it's just like, oh right, this is what's next.
Yeah. So, and that doesn't mean that that's then, you know, set in stone. Like he's incredible at like the detail of which his notes, at which his notes come in, you know, is remarkable. And it really tells you who he is as a musician, as a, and as an artist. His attention to detail is incredible. He might not know like the terminology, let's say in my department, he might not know the terminology of how he wants something played, but he knows when it's right. And he trusts me to get it there, hopefully as quickly as possible. But he'll be able to tell you what's wrong with it. You know what I mean? So it's really an incredible team effort between the three of us. And I really feel like, you know, this as a trio, I've never performed as a trio in front of this many people, let alone with two iconic musicians, one of which is a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. So yeah, it's really like, you know, the most humbling experience I could ever be a part of.
I watched the one of the, while we're recording this, the Euros are on. I watched the an England game the other day with a very celebrated musician who kind of plays arenas, and his favorite artist of all time is Sting, and he came to see you at Plymouth on Sunday, last Sunday, and he was saying that the thing that was most endearing about it actually is that there were a few errors, and it was like really nice to see like little bits go wrong at times. And that almost felt like he was watching a new band get together, like those first rehearsals. And it felt very raw and very kind of energetic and young. And he said it was like an absolutely amazing show. Sting's known as kind of a great songwriter and has an incredible voice. And sometimes the fact that, you know, he's a bit of a rarity that he's a singer and a bassist, you know, a lead singer and a performer and a bassist at the same time, goes maybe to some a little bit under the radar. So let's talk about Sting the bassist. Tell us about locking in as a rhythm section with him, and what are his qualities as a bassist?
First up, he's an incredible, incredible bass player. You know, he's very accomplished. I think between, you know, him and Paul McCartney probably are like, you know, two bass players that get overlooked a lot of the time, you know, and because everyone looks at them as artists, but forgets that, you know, playing bass lines, quite complex bass lines at times, although he would beg to differ, but, and singing at the same time is really difficult, you know, just like drumming and singing is very difficult, hence why, you know, some of my favorite drummers are, you know, your Phil Collins and your Levon Helms and stuff like that. But his bass playing for me to lock in as a drummer is, it's really funny. It's really funny, mate. Like, he's very ahead of the beat. He's always right on top of the beat, right? But so you're constantly sort of trying to hold him back of rushing, but he needs to feel like you're pushing him. So it's like Dominic, the guitarist, he explained this to me before we started, and he was like, just be aware of the fact that, you know, he sits on top of the beat, but he needs you to make the song feel like you're pushing the song along, but don't get ahead of him. And I was like, that's a very small sliver of land I can, you know, sit in there. And he was like, you'll see what I mean once we get going. And he's been doing this for, you know, 35 plus years or something crazy at, you know, by Sting's side, so he knows exactly where he likes to sit in the bar, you know. And yeah, absolutely, he was on the money, and that's exactly where he is, because a lot, you know, some tracks are on click. And if they're on a click, he will sit so far on top of the click that sometimes I just look at the playback tech and I'm like, we might have to turn the click off now, because there comes a time where like the energy of a live set might require you to speed up in a chorus and then to come back down in a verse. You know, that's very natural for a song to do that. So I don't really want to be the guy who sits you know, behind his drum set and just has the click in his ears and is like, well, no, if the bass player now, you know, rushes, well, the artist who's also the bass player rushes away with the song, there's not really that much backing track, you know, apart from like maybe two songs, so that we couldn't kill the track. So there has been occasions, absolutely, where, you know, he was, the energy of the song in the moment just felt like it needed to go with Sting rather than me trying to rein everyone in to, no, lads, this is the click with my tempo, please. You know, I don't think that's a wise thing to do. So I have to make that decision on the fly. And we've, you know, I sort of give the playback tech like a death stare, and then he kills the track, and we just go with where Sting is at. And I still sort of pull him, you know, try and hold him back as much as I can, but I feel like it makes it helps the energy of the song in the moment. So rather
this,
than
this tightrope that the show is almost on, which is so interesting as a viewer to watch in some ways, is obviously by design. And
yes,
maybe the fact that, you know, when you walked in and he said, right, here's a list of 72 songs and you didn't know them, was almost like the assessment of like, will you be able to manage having not had lots of rehearsals that we're going to do an hour and a half beforehand and just be like, okay. So it's really interesting you say that. So if you were to have your time again, or if you were to advise, we have a lot of young musicians or emerging musicians listening to this. If someone was to be in that situation again, and they're with, you know, an artist the scale of Sting, and he's saying, right, here's 72 songs and you only know 20 or 30 of them, what would you do? Well, what advice would you give them to get through that next couple of hours or that day?
I mean, I would say just do your best. You know what I mean? Be yourself. Like, I was very sort of crippled by imposter syndrome. Still am in parts, you know, because I don't think it's possible to come on to this gig of all, you know. I think there's only a few gigs like this one in the world. But I think to come onto this gig in 2024 as any drummer in the world without even the slightest slither of imposter syndrome, you'd have to be dead inside, honestly. You know, the people that have come before me on this gig, any drummer before me on this gig is literally a lifelong inspiration of mine, hero of mine, you know, all the way from Stuart to Josh and then Zach. So they all have different qualities. They all are incredibly good at what they do. So to come in and be like, hey guys, I'm the new guy, you know, alongside a musical partnership that is 35 plus years strong. And here comes the guy from Luxembourg who's no one ever heard of. You know what I mean? It's like, it's really hard. Like, it's really hard. And for the longest time, when we started this, you know, the first batch of rehearsals, I was trying to play like Vinny. I was trying to play like Josh. I was trying to play like Omar. I was trying to sound like Stuart. You know what I mean? All this stuff. And he hated it. He hated it. He was like, what are you doing? And I was like, well, that's the fill from, you know, this live version that, you know, Stuart did when blah, whatever. And he was like, yeah, stop doing that. Why would you do that? Don't play a fill there. And I was like, okay, fair enough. And that kept going, you know, because I thought the way I will tip my hat to the people before me is by sort of alluring to, you know, the way they played the music. But in fact, what he wanted me to do, the reason he hired me, is because he wanted me to play the songs the way I would have played them. And I think that's my best advice, is that don't do what I did, but also do what I did, but don't do the first part where I tried to be everyone else. Just be yourself. You know what I mean? Be yourself, trust in yourself, and trust that you have enough to bring to the table, and work hard and be nice to people. That's really all it is. There is no, people always think about the industry as like, there's got to be a secret hack somewhere, you know, how I can skip the queue or like do this or do that. But there isn't. There isn't. And the secret really is that if you're a good person and you're a pleasure to be around and you're on time and you work hard and yeah, that's literally it, you know. There's nothing else you can do. So just trust in yourself, trust in your ability. And the reason you were asked to be in the room is proof enough that you're there for a reason. Therefore, it's your gig.
Exactly. So, you know, it's really interesting you share that, because with the whole imposter syndrome thing, there is a reason why Sting would have picked you, right? So he would have considered lots of drummers. He might have auditioned drummers, but he went, right, I want Chris Marsh to do this. I'm going to fly him over to New York and rehearse for days in Manhattan. And it's really funny how the person on the shoulder has got that, you know, has that level of self-doubt. That's so fascinating. Now, if your dad hadn't been a drummer in a brass band, what job do you think you'd be doing right now? Would you be a drummer? Would you be in the music industry? Or would you be doing something else?
But you know what? I've never asked myself that question. That's a great question. I don't think for a second that I would be a drummer. No. No, because that's where it all started. That's where I got the bug. That's where, you know. That's a very difficult question. I don't think I know the answer to that, honestly. I don't like to think about it, but
I'm sure people, the kids you grew up with, or the people you grew up with, where you were.
Yeah,
what careers do they have? What's the average career that people are doing there? What would be the different pathway if your dad hadn't been a drummer?
Do you know what? Like most people in Luxembourg, are teachers.
Yeah,
because unlike elsewhere in Luxembourg, a teacher is like, it's the golden ticket, you know. You work very hard, but you get paid a ton of money and you have school holidays. So I'd probably be a teacher. Because that's
nicely,
what most, yeah, go ahead.
Because you said, which brings you nicely, because I think you studied music in Luxembourg and then you also studied music in the UK. Is that right? If so, how do the two philosophies of education differ? What did you notice as kind of big differences from one from the other?
I studied first at a music school, a regular music school, from when I was like 6 until I was about 12. I studied at a regular music school. I did like music theory, and then, you know, that's where I started my drum lessons. My dad like got me these drum lessons with a tutor, and in Luxembourg, the whole music education is very formal. So like for the first like 2 years, when my dad was paying me to get drum lessons, my drum tutor at the time was basically said, we have to do 2 years of snare drum before you can sit at a drum set.
Wow.
And I was like, well, no, I can play a beat. You know what I mean? Let me show you. And he was like, I don't want to see it. What we're going to do now is, he opened like stick control, page one. And we sat next to each other with two snare drums. And it was 2 years of just, you know, etudes and rudiments. And and in hindsight, I couldn't be more thankful, you know, because it really what set like the foundation for the fact that I've never had any problems with my hands, knock on wood. I have always, you know, I still practice like most days, you know, do at least like half an hour a day just to keep chops like loose and everything. And, but I at 13, I moved to the Conservatory of Music in Luxembourg, which very different. You know, very jazz based. So I studied there. I did musical theory, harmony, and drum lessons, as well as a couple of like combos, like jazz combos and stuff. But it was like, it's like a more traditional music school, you know, jazz conservatory. And when I graduated from there, which was in 2004, I moved to London in 2005. I moved to London in 2006, actually. And I wanted a radical change because I come through the conservatory, which is, you know, they don't really go, they don't really teach you, they don't really teach you Led Zeppelin or Van Halen at the conservatory, you know what I mean? But that's the sort of music I was into at the time. So I wanted to change that up and sort of, I was looking for schools where I could become a session player and learn popular music, you know, like rock music, pop music, funk music. Like I wanted to be able to play it all. But and even though the music conservatory had given me the tools to play all these different styles at the time, I felt very well prepared, but I needed to get out of the country because the resources and the opportunities in Luxembourg are very limited for a session musician, you know. So I needed to go to either America or London or Berlin, maybe Paris. And I chose London because, you know, a lot of my favorite bands are English, and I felt that, you know, I've always had this dream of living in London. And so I went to school in London. I did 2 years at a music college over there. And then, you know, that was great for the first time, like living in London in my early 20s, you know, it's really fantastic. And I got to meet so many great people, you know, some of which I'm still in touch today. And I really learned, like, you know, what it takes, because the people teaching at the college, like, they were session musicians. They were playing in bands. They were, you know, whether it was like some were in the West End, some were in, you know, touring with bands. Like, so that to me was like, wow, like, you know, if I make it through this, then I might one day I might be, you know, one of you guys. And that was great. That was great. And then, you know, sort of, after my second year, I took a gap year because I had, you know, through going to jam sessions and stuff like that, like I basically ended up getting this touring opportunity in 2007. And I had to take it. And the college was very encouraging of that. You know, they really encouraged you to go and look for opportunities. And if you had the opportunity to go on the road, then they would really encourage that and sort of give you time off. And so I did that. And then, yeah, and then I just kept the ball rolling, I guess, you know. Then I took another gap year after that. And then, you know, it was never, you know, I was never working all the way through, but I felt that there were steady increments in the amount of work I was getting. And it was tough at times, you know, because at the start, as everyone knows, you know, you're in a van, you're like sleeping on people's floors, but, you know, they were still super fun years. And then eventually I was able to, like, you know, hold myself steady and, you know, grow and bigger shows suddenly. And then I never went back to school. I'm still on a gap year. It's now 17 years later. You know,
do you have fever dreams where you're like, oh, I haven't finished my exams?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, who knows? One day, I'm not opposed to the idea that one day I might go and finish it. You know what I mean? But for now, I'm gonna keep touring. But maybe one day I'll get that degree.
You know? So your dad didn't have drum lessons, but you did. What can you do your dad couldn't, and what could your dad do that you can't?
Well, that's a great question. That's a really, another question I've never asked myself. You're really good at these. I'll tell you what, my dad once said to me when I was a little boy that he would stop playing drums the day he felt like I was better than him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Has he stopped yet?
He's still playing. No. He stopped when I was, I think, like 12 or 13.
Wow.
And I said, I was so upset. And I was like, why? Why would you stop? And he was like, because I just want to be there for you. And I want to concentrate on basically, like, you know, basically pushing you forward. Right. And he would still sometimes like sit down and stuff. But at the time of when I started taking lessons, he actually went back into lessons and also started again. And he hadn't taken lessons for decades. You know what I mean? So he actually started taking lessons again. And we would always, like, you know, practice together and stuff, you know, although we only had one drum set, but he would like have a turn, and then I would have a turn, play the same song and stuff. I have such like vivid memories and like such happy memories of that happening. And then he stopped and he was like, I think it's your time, you know, you should maximize time on the kit. And, but the kit was set up in, you know, this room that was sort of like this small room that also had his, like, a desk in it where he would like work. And so the kit was set up opposite the desk like this, so that he could work and I could practice, you know what I mean? And he did that on purpose so that he could watch me practice. And then I would play along to his song. And then this is after he stopped playing. He basically became just a critic. And he would just sit on his desk, and then I'd play a song, and he'd be like, yeah, well, you know, what you did there, the transition of this and this, this fill, and also you were a bit sloppy in the timing. And I was like, okay, you know. But that was basically it. And he's very knowledgeable as a musician, and obviously from as my dad, you know what I mean? And he guided me alongside all my drum tutors, you know. He was always my harshest critic, but I knew that I could trust his judgment. And still to this day, you know, like, I love my dad more than anything. And I have, like I said in the answer before, you know, if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be here today. Not just physically, but also as a drummer. I think I have everything to thank him for. You know, and
two quite interesting gigs you also had was that you were Examples drummer for a bit, and so I'm kind of interested how that stretched you technically. But also, I know that you had to do some shows with Mumford and Sons where I think you're only playing three songs for out of quite a long set, which is quite a different challenge, I'd imagine, just coming off and coming on again. Talk about those two challenges. So firstly, how they compare. So the Example gig with the Mumford and Sons gig, what were the challenges as a what have you learned from those experiences?
Well, the gig opportunity I mentioned in my last answer that took me out of college was Example.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And he was the first act or artist that gave me the opportunity to prove myself when I'd moved to London. Didn't know anyone. I'd moved to London with two of my best friends, and all the people that I met there, you know what I mean? Like, we're all from music college and jams and open mic nights and stuff like that. And he was the first artist that, like, you know, through a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend, someone heard somewhere that they were auditioning for drummers. And somehow it trickled down to me. And I remember I was like, it was like a Friday night or something, but I was at home, about to go out. And then the phone rang, and it was one of my housemates. And he was like, hey, I just met this bass player who's like a friend of a friend, and he was the bass player for Example. And they were like, they're auditioning drummers, so I put you forward for it. And I was like, great. So then, yeah, I walked down a couple of days later, I think on a Monday, I walked down to Premises Studios in East London on Hackney Road. And I met him for the first time, and we had a play. And we got on really well, and I got the gig there and then. And then we went on the road with the Streets.
Really? Wow,
yeah.
Nice.
It was really fun. super fun. We did like a support tour with the Streets and a couple of other, like Professor Green at the time, and a couple of acts that were on Mike Skinner's label. And that was super fun. And then we just toured. We did headline tours with Example after that, which were like club gigs, you know, like really sweaty, like club gigs that were so fun. And then afterwards, I left after like a year and a half or so. I left and I went and did my own thing. And then I came back to this gig in 2013. I came back to Example because John Jenkins, who's the musical director for Example at the time, was moving gigs and needed someone to fill his fill the gap with Example. So he called me and he said, would you be up for coming back on? And I was like, yeah, but by this time Example is an arena act. So it's no more like dingy clubs, you know, like little basement raves, but it's now like big raves. And yeah, John really did an incredible job alongside Elliot and Andy and Kai at the time, who were the band. And I sort of just came in and we went on the road and played. I did like two big tours with them. And that was sort of like a really nice full circle moment, you know, for me to have had my first gigging opportunity with that artist and then be able to come back like so many years later. And he'd grown so much as an artist, but I'd also grown as a player. The gig had grown, the crowds had grown, everything was bigger and better. So it was a really beautiful way of tying that up, you know. And that gig was crazy. Crazy, like the way that Johnny had it was my first time, like, you know, it was my first time where I saw like two laptops running the show. Like there was a separate laptop running the kit, you know, all the automation, like the show files, like everything. It was my first time watching like Ableton, like really, like those guys at the time. There's a guy called Sean who works together with Johnny, and together they programmed the show, and they were so like far ahead of the curve when it came to all like, you know, building shows and all of that. And Elliot's show was Example's shows were at the time, and still now, you know, although he doesn't use a live band anymore, but they were incredible. It's so energetic. They're so well put together. We used to have like 4 or 5 song clusters, so that once you press go on a cluster, it was basically like 25 minutes, and the segues were usually drum led. So you're just playing like at full speed for 25 minutes.
Yeah, right. So this is a really interesting thing. So I've spoken to other drummers who had similar gigs, and yeah. How did you physically? Because you're playing very high BPM consistently like hour and a half shows pretty much.
Yeah,
that is a very different challenge. Like, how did you have to get into the, you know, did you, I know people have taken up boxing and stuff like that in the past to like really get themselves into shape to be able to keep up that kind of what's the word I'm looking for, stamina, to be able to do those shows. Like, how did it, must have been quite a different thing for you, I guess, or did you take it in your stride?
It really was like especially like Elliot, you know, he's a very physical guy on stage. Like, you know, he really, you know, excuse the pun, but like leads by example in terms of, you know, he will give the crowd everything and he will tire himself out on stage, but will expect the same from his band and the crowd. And when that all happens, it's almost like, you know, everyone starts levitating sort of thing. You know what I mean? Like, it's really like, there were some nights where, you know, like I'll never forget these, you know, that we played, one of my favorite venues in the country is Barrowlands in Glasgow, you know, nice. And when that place is packed and everyone's going absolutely mental, I don't think there's a better venue in the UK, you know, really, it's truly remarkable. But to play, because a lot of it was like, it was sort of like, you know, when I first started with him, it was sort of like this, it was rap, it was like British rap, you know what I mean? But with a lot of samples but then when I came back, the music had sort of evolved and was now sort of almost like, it was like drum and a lot of it was drum and bass. It was almost like, you know, Faithless meets The Prodigy. Like it was just, it was crazy. It was very dark and it was just like really fast drum and bass. And, but then like, you know, you'd cut it back into this like super heavy halftime thing. And it was like, you know, that was almost like a metal band, you know what I mean? And it was so much fun to play. But from a stamina point of view, yeah, it was ice baths after every show because it was just, it was heavy. I wasn't used to that kind of, to that level of performance, you know?
There's a lot of young musicians listening to this. And one of the scary things about going into the music industry, I think, that isn't talked about enough is the fluctuations in salary that people get, right? So people could go into kind of normal jobs. You talked about teaching earlier, and like, you know, the steadiness of that monthly payment that you get paid on the last Friday of the month, whatever it would be. Mm-hmm. And it's not always like that in the music industry at all. You can get mm-hmm. periods where you get paid really well and then there's nothing. How do you best deal with that, or how would you advise musicians to best deal with that who might actually be scared of in some way of going into the industry or actually step away from the industry, not because they're not getting the money, but they're not guaranteed the stability?
That's a really great question. I think the best way of dealing with it is to embrace it and don't have a plan B. Meaning, the nature of that job is never going to change. You know, I've been doing this for so long now, and I'm still faced with those facts every day, you know. And although it does get easier, the higher paid the jobs get, you know, the more easy it becomes to put some money aside and stuff. But like, we all start out on the same line. And what I mean by not having a plan B is like, do whatever it takes, basically. You know, I had to hold like jobs alongside being a musician when I couldn't make rent at the end of the month. But right. I didn't mind that because it was all, you know, feeding my dream of becoming a session musician and being able to one day call that, you know, off and just be a musician and tour the world, hopefully. You know, that dream was what carried me through like shifts at the pub, or like, you know, I was a you know, in the lead up to when, before I tried to move to London, I was a bus mechanic. Like I was driving airport shuttle service. You know what I mean? Like I was doing all these things because I needed to save the money to essentially, like, you know, make my dream come true of hopefully one day being able to tour with people and travel the world, you know? And I think that if you truly believe in that and you put that out there, you know, not to go all like hippie on you here, but like, if you, I'm a very strong believer in the power of the universe and the sort of the law of attraction and stuff like that. So I do believe that if you really believe in something, you know, and you manifest it and you just put it out there, I do believe that it comes true. And, you know, I would be lying if I said that, you know, if it wasn't for my parents, like I couldn't have moved to London. You know, there were times at the start of my career, my parents paid for my tuition fees, you know, to actually get access to this college in London. Like, you know, I wasn't able to pay that for myself, you know, but I tried to carry as much of the costs when I first moved by, you know, having jobs around college. And then even later, you know, after, you know, I came back from the tour, I thought, well, this is it. You know, I've been on a tour bus now. I've been in a splitter and I'm ready for the next step. You know, when can I step on the private plane? And then this really rude awakening came where, you know, my phone didn't ring. I'd done like one tour, you know, and my phone didn't ring for like 2 months. And I panicked and I was like, you know, I had like a bit of money and then I'd spent it all as quickly as I'd earned it. And then, yeah, it was just, that was it. You know, I had to check myself and just be like, you're nobody, mate. Like, you've just started, you've done one tour, chill out and get a job and then start again, you know. And being a session musician is a little bit like being a skateboarder, you know, or like a photographer. Like, you work for that one trick for so long and then you land it, being like, you get the gig, you do the tour, and then you try and learn a new trick. So then you fall over all the time again, you know what I mean? Like, and that falling over is basically being at home. Like, you're sat at home waiting for the opportunity to land a tour again. And once you land that tour, you know, it's smooth sailing again. But that sort of roller coaster nature of the job never goes away. In fact, I believe that the longer you stay in the industry, actually the higher the highs and the lower the lows become.
Really?
Which is something that people don't talk about nearly quite enough. You know, it's something that is brushed under the carpet quite a lot, and that I actively encourage people to talk about more, because I think that's really important that we lift the sort of veil on, you know, the darkness that is time off sometimes, you know, to some people. Like, if you come from the highest of highs, you know, you've just experienced like pure adrenaline on tour, and you then like come off the road and you don't necessarily have another gig lined up, people fall into depression, you know, myself included. Like, people, like you said, like, you know, what about like facing the fact that you might not know when your next gig comes from, where your next paycheck comes from? That's a reality that we all deal with, you know, and that we just sort of have to take for what it is, you know. And even though, you know, the more your network grows of people that you know and artists that you've worked with, the more likely you are to get work, a working opportunity again quicker. But that doesn't mean that it will come, you know. Like, coming out of the pandemic, I remember like I sat at home for like 6 months, my phone didn't ring. And I had to delete like social media because I couldn't face another day of like, you know, opening social media and seeing all my friends were touring. And I was like, wow, what happened? You know, like, why is no one calling me? Like, this is so weird, you know? And I just fell into like this really, really dark spiral. Yeah, it was quite hard to dig myself out of that, you know, after I just finished like a 2-year arena campaign with Mumford & Sons, playing the biggest shows on the planet, you know, for myself. And but that's the reality of it, is that the way of getting around it is to preempt it, the down period, by working whilst you're on the up. And that's really tough, because most people, when they're on tour and when they're on the up and they're enjoying themselves and they're playing shows, you know, the last thing they want to do is like do extracurriculum work and you know, meet people. And like, when you're on the road, you feel like you're untouchable, you know, you're the one that's touring, you're the one on stage every night. But actually, that's the time you should be the most humble, and that's the time where you should be reaching out to people and, you know, building new bridges and meeting new people, and so that you're preempting the time where, you know, every tour ends, every tour comes to an end, and every gig comes to an end. And if you can be smart enough to sort of try and preempt that and line up work for the time in the future, you know, then I think to a certain extent you can minimize that time period in between gigs, and therefore, you know, keep a positive mental attitude all the way through. But to cut it out completely is impossible.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
Listen, thank you for sharing that. And that's so insightful. And you have lifted that veil, which is really interesting. You said, I was actually going to ask how you kind of shorten the distance between those, the kind of the big drop and the kind of huge highs, which you actually, the preemptive idea is makes so much sense. You said that when you were in a hole, how did you dig yourself out of it?
By putting myself out of my comfort zone.
Which was what?
Which I didn't like.
Networking and trying to find other gigs and that type of thing.
Oh my God. It was horrible, but it was...
You don't have to share if you don't want to.
No, of course. No, of course I'll share it because it's important. You know what I mean? But like, I come from a time where like, you know, I did all my networking and open mic nights and all of that. You know, I did all that when you start out, and then you just... At a certain point, you just meet people, you know, through other musicians that you work with, and your social network sort of grows. And most of my friends are musicians and other, you know, instrumentalists and stuff and singers. And digging myself out of this one was particularly hard because I, believe it or not, and this, I don't want this to come across the wrong way, but I've never had to ask for work in my life. I've always been so incredibly fortunate that I've had opportunities, even though sometimes a little bit far apart, but like I've always worked on my time off, on myself, on my technique, on my playing, on my hearing, on my, you know, all of that. And then the next opportunity will present itself. You take it and then you do a great job and then hopefully another one will come. And then, like I said before, you know, you try and shorten those periods in between. After the pandemic, which I sort of see as this great equalizer, where suddenly like everyone was at home, every musician in London and everywhere else in the country was suddenly at home and available. And then the artists were gearing up to start touring again. And they were spoiled for choice because you could get every musician in the world to play on your music, depending on your budget, obviously. But like, that was a crazy situation to be in as a musician. Suddenly you were like faced with more, you know, like they're not your rivals or anything, but like, you know, it's competition. So you're faced with more competition than ever before because everyone is at home and absolutely gagging for a gig. You know what I mean? So when that didn't happen for me, and when I suddenly, you know, went through 6 months of not being able to work, I was like, what else can I do other than just ask for work now? And I spoke to my partner about it, and she was like, why don't you email, like, you know, a producer or a musical director or an artist even, you know, why don't you just send them like a cold email and see if they reply and just say that you're available, because a lot of people might not think you're available. And I was like, I was mortified. I was like, no, I'm not doing that. I was like, you don't understand how my industry is very different from yours. You know, she works for a tech company. Like that's very different. I was like, you don't just email people and go like, hi, you know, just so you know, I'm available for sessions and, you know, studio and live. You know, so if you need someone, just, you know, feel free to reach out, or, you know. And she was like, well, how else are you going to get work? Like, you're just going to continue to sit at home and just, you know, feel sad for yourself and stare at your phone, which is currently still at 100% charge, but hasn't rung in 6 months. And I was like, that's a very fair reality check. Thank you very much. So, so I wrote one email a day. Is what I did. And I did that for quite a long time, quite a few weeks. And I wrote an email a day that was, something I'd never done, but I wrote an email a day to all different kinds of people, from like label guys to management to MDs to producers to musicians, one email a day. And I actively encouraged, you know, like face-to-face contact again with other musicians. So I went out, met loads of people, showed face, let people know that I was available and looking for work, you know. And but those cringy emails, man, one came off. That's all it took, you know. And someone, I can't even remember who it was, but there was a guy at the record label who reached out and was like, hey, I got your email through so-and-so. Would you be able to do like 2 days for me recording in this studio with this artist? And I was like, this is it. It's worked. And I attributed all of that success to the cold emails and the fact that, you know, for the first time I put myself out there as a musician that, you know, a lot of people think of who's always busy, always working, always touring, you know. I was not. And there is no musician that's always touring. It's not a thing. It's,
and also, you know, some of those musicians would have been thinking, oh, Chris Masters has always been like snapped up by someone already, so I won't even be asking them. There is that thing, and I totally get. And also, I wonder, and you don't have to answer this, but I wonder if the ripple effect of ever sending those emails ultimately led to you playing with Sting 3.0. Like, that might have been eventually the people that got on the radar, and eventually it got on Sting's radar, eventually who you were, you know. So it was having to the answer to your question there is you stepped outside your comfort zone. That was literally
absolutely
it. The moment you stepped outside your comfort zone, things started to happen. And, you know, I think most people know this, but from a developmental point of view, you know, the world begins on the edge of your comfort zone. That's where the doors start opening up, right? So
I couldn't agree more. Yeah,
that's so interesting. We'll begin to wrap up in a moment. Last couple of questions from me. If you were to find out tomorrow that an asteroid was to hit the planet Earth, you'd obviously be like, this would be obviously quite devastating news, and you want to spend all your time with your family and stuff like that. But if you allowed yourself 1 minute to be regretful about something you never got round to musically, what would it be?
Last year, I was touring with an American artist called Maggie Rogers. She's a young female artist, incredibly talented, unbelievable. And I was touring with her for the majority of last year, and I absolutely loved that. I absolutely loved the band, great co-MDs in Brian Kesley and Bryn Bliska, incredible. Great management, great tour management. It was really a full package gig, like, you know. And I was in the midst of renegotiating sort of, you know, where we were moving forward, because she was having, you know, she was making another record. So there was ongoing talks and stuff. But then out of nowhere, basically, old mate swooped in and I got the call to go and basically meet Sting, and he pitched to me the idea of this three-piece, and he was very respectful, and he said, we understand that you have existing commitments, you know, which you will honor. And I was like, I do, but I haven't signed anything, and I am a first come first serve guy. So, you know, if, and basically, long story short, is they managed to wrap their ends up before the other team. And so, you know, obviously that's the sort of the boring side of it. The other side is the fact that, you know, this is Sting asking me to be in a trio with him, which, you know, every time I say it out loud, I'm just like chuckling to myself, you know, it's just absolutely mad. But I think, to answer your question, I think I would have loved to continue that journey with Maggie and her band, because they are now, even though, you know, they found an incredible replacement in a guy called Jordan Rhodes, who's, you know, phenomenal drummer, great pocket, very, very deep pocket. And they're having great, the band sounds fantastic, but they are now moving, you know, into arenas for the first time in America. And as an artist, I've always wanted to be a part of, you know, that step where you go from like playing multiple like academies to like your first arena show, you know what I mean? Like that to me is such a special moment to be a part of. And I think that I was, you know, when we first heard about the possibility of her basically headlining her first arena this year, everyone was so like gassed about that. And then this opportunity with Sting came up, and I was like, go and find me a single musician on this planet who will say, no, excuse me, Sting, I'm all right. You know, not for me. Love your stuff, but not for me. This. So I was just like, this isn't fair. You know what I mean? Like, there's only like a few artists in the whole world that could literally, I would drop things for, you know what I mean? So, and Sting is one of them, you know? So there was, in a parallel universe, I definitely would have loved, well, I am still playing with Maggie, but you know, to answer your question, yeah, I would have loved to see that tour through this year and move into arenas. And I think but it's not a regret, you know what I mean? Because she's doing it. And even though I'm not there to do it with her and the band, doesn't mean that it's not going well. It's not a musical regret of mine because I'm currently the drummer for Sting. I don't have any musical regret in sight, but I feel like if I could have done it differently, but I would love to get a glimpse into that parallel universe where I'm on tour with them still and someone else has got my spot here, but I wouldn't change anything right now for anything in the world. You know what I mean?
So you've given loads of great advice through the last kind of hour or so. What's the best bit of advice anyone's ever given you? And we'll finish there. So what's the best bit of advice anyone's ever given you?
The best bit of advice, I mean, there's a lot of great advice, and still people give me advice all the time. The best bit of advice would probably be the bit that I said earlier. You know, when people ask me about shortcuts, people ask me shortcuts all the time. Kids coming out of school, they're like, how can I get to where you are as quickly as possible? And the truth of the matter is there is no shortcut. You know, if you want longevity, then you have to build slowly. Your foundation has to be very sturdy. And in order to, it's coming back to those 2 years on the snare drum before I sat at the drum kit, you know. People rush through things all the time nowadays because they want to get to what they think is the destination. And I'm not going to go all again, you know, it's about the journey. It's like, no, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the foundation of what you build your career on has to be super solid. And it takes more than being able to play 16 against 12 or, you know, 11 to get a gig in, you know, in the industry. In fact, I believe that when I started out, I used to think that like half of your job is your ability of playing the instrument and half of it is the social aspect of, you know, being around people and getting on with people and, you know. And now that I've been doing it for like coming up to pretty much 20 years now, I can honestly tell you that it's 70-30, 65-35. I would go 70-30 towards your social skills being more important than your playing. Because an artist wants to surround himself or herself or themselves with good people, and so should you. You know, that's the most important thing. Surround yourself with good people, people that think like you and people that bring the best out of you. The playing aspect, which I'm not saying at all like don't prepare or like, you know, any of that. Always be prepared. But the playing aspect at this level is all, or at any level, is a given. You have to be good to hold your own in the industry. That's a given. But it's really hard to distinguish yourself from other players purely by from a playing perspective. You know what I mean? Because every player in the industry, especially in London, is very good at what they do. They're very, very good players, you know. There is very, very good players who are mad, like beasts, have chops like for days, you know. There's an incredible bag of players who have like the deepest pockets, like all of this. They're all there. And how are you going to choose? Well, you're going to choose by choosing the one that you like hanging out the most. It's that simple. And so to me, the time you spend on stage is literally, if you're playing an arena level, stadium level gig, even maybe it's 2 hours, it's very rarely over 2 hours, let's face it. That's 22 hours left in the day that you're not working, right? Let's say you do an hour sound check. Okay, 20, 21 hours that you're not working. Whether you will be traveling, you'll be eating, you'll be watching movies, sitting on in a van, like sitting in a bar at a restaurant, whatever it is, you'll be socializing with the people around you on the gig. But you won't be playing your instrument. And so that's so important. I can't stress that enough, really, how important that is, that you're a good person first and foremost. And then a good musician, because being a good musician alone will never get you out of, you know, your practice room or your bedroom, wherever you practice. You know what I mean? Like you can be the best musician in the world and still not get a gig.
Listen,
but at the same time, you know, if you have an innate set of skills that you've been honing over the course of years and years, and you're a good guy, you're a good person to be around, you're much more likely to get an opportunity that will lead on to a career in music, I believe, personally. You know, people might disagree with me, but this is something that's worked for me. You know, I'm not the best drummer in the world. I'm not pretending to be, you know, but I guess I'm not a bad guy. You know, which says something, you know. But I'm a good pint, you know. But
I a friend of mine once said that he was auditioning for drummer, and like they were saying, look, what, you know, what's his style, etc. And just one of them was just like, is he a good person to go for a pint with? He literally said that exact phrase. And it's like, okay, well, what's a person to go for a pint with? There we go. So that validates everything that you just said there. Listen, thank you so much for your wisdom, your advice, your vulnerability. You know, enjoy your time off in Florence now. Drink red wine,
eat pizza,
eat pasta. good luck in from Athens from next week in the shows with 3.0 with Sting. Keep those emails being sent out to make sure that you've got some work coming in on the
absolutely
downside.
Absolutely.
But I'm sure you'll be fine. But listen, thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Thank you so much, Chris. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you. I had the best time.